Welcome back. I'm Amy Robinson. For the past 8 months, WCMU has been working on a project exploring issues around one of Michigan's most valuable resources, water. Michigan Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities provided funding to allow us to host a series of community conversations. At our first conversation, last fall in Alpena, we invited educators, fishermen, community volunteers, retirees, and outdoor enthusiasts, among others, to talk about the issue of rights and access to water. Community members talked to each other, and they listened to two experts that we invited along for the evening. First, we hear from Jim Johnson. For years, he led the DNR's Lake Huron Fisheries Research Station in Alpena. He got to know probably more than he wanted to about invasive species, and that's what he talked about in our conversation.
The Great Lakes were doing great until invasive species came along. They did not require stocking or management until sea lampreys showed up. The Great Lakes were doing just fine, thank you, and did not need fish biologists like me until invasive species came. So I guess you could say invasive species have been a sort of employment guarantee for fisheries biologists in Michigan, but that's a pretty weak upside to the invasive species problem. So I'll give a brief history.
Yes.
I'm an old guy, so I'll give an old guy's view of invasive species, which starts back with the time when the Great Lakes had no friends because they had no fish. Imagine, if you will, the Ice Age and the ice pushing all the way to the Niagara Escarpment, Niagara Falls, and so on, pushing Canadian species of fish in front of it, and then retreating and leaving them there. But the falls remained. So all these Great Lakes fish were trapped behind Niagara Falls, and we had like an aquarium of Canada. Our species were mostly representative of northern climes that really, lake trout don't belong this far south, but they were doing just fine down here because they were isolated from the other invaders from the Atlantic Ocean by Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls was the guardian of the Great Lakes for 10,000 or more years. And then we built the St. Lawrence Seaway around the falls, and all these saltwater boats came up. I'm talking saltwater boats, not our ore carriers. I'm talking about the ones from overseas that brought these invasive species from other countries.
What year are you talking?
And we're talking the 1940s, when it really opened up, especially the World War II years, when the Seaway was so heavily used. It had recently been opened. Now it was being used to fire up the war effort, and shipping was probably the heaviest it's ever been during that period. And so this first wave of invasives, which were the worst culprits, were sea lampreys and alewives came through the system. Alewives may have come up, for all we know, they might have come up the Erie Canal. But one way or another, alewives thought they were quite certain the lampreys came up on the bottom of saltwater ships. And the lampreys quickly found lake trout to their liking. And if you think of lake trout as the apex predator of the Great Lakes, just as wolves are the apex predator of Yellowstone, without these apex predators, chaos breaks out. Everything can reproduce and do just fine, except there's nothing to control their numbers. That's the role of lake trout, is to control the numbers of the lower food web species. They were gone suddenly. They just disappeared. Overfishing didn't help. The sea lampreys pushed them over the edge. And alewives came up about the same time and exploded. With no predators to control them, the only way they could die was of old age, basically. They died of various causes. All kinds of people tried to attribute the loss to this, that, or another thing. But basically, there was no natural mechanism for them to be thinned out by a predator, so they just died and rolled up on our beaches. Now we're talking the early 1960s. And at that time, our beaches were almost useless unless you had front-end loaders to clean them. Not many people in this room, some I can see, remember that era. Some can remember when there weren't salmon in the Great Lakes and when all we had was what some people called alewife soup. And every so often, and it usually happened right at the beginning of the tourist season, waves of dead alewives would wash ashore. The front-end loaders would get out there and quickly try to clear some swimming areas. But basically, the lakes stunk. Who's going to use those lakes? And what friends did the lakes have? And this is, to me, this is the most important thing that came out of invasive species, is just how important it is that people express themselves and make their concerns known, because the agencies are supposed to be managing these lakes on behalf of the citizens of the state under public trust doctrine. It's the agency's responsibility to do this, but the DNR gets no money from the general fund. It only gets money from fishing dollars. No one was fishing the Great Lakes, so nobody managed the Great Lakes from the state. Some federal agencies moved in and were managing on the Great Lakes, but they didn't really have a role on the Great Lakes. They were kind of treading on thin ice. These are state waters, and the state wasn't doing anything. If you don't buy a fishing license, incidentally, you don't help manage the Great Lakes, because that's where the money comes from. And with no fishing, no voices out there. And these assaults were happening continuously to the Great Lakes, and people were not speaking up. They didn't have a voice. And then two guys, Wayne Todi and Howard Tanner, and whether you like this idea or not, decided to take a couple of species of salmon from the Pacific Ocean and stock them in the Great Lakes to make use of these alewives. Now, who could have done that today? Can you imagine somebody saying, hey, let's put striped bass in the Atlantic Ocean in the Great Lakes and single-handedly do it? You couldn't do that today because people would scream bloody murder. But back then, there were no voices. And Wayne Todi and Howard Tanner imported the salmon, had them in the hatcheries, and then published a report saying salmon for the Great Lakes in 1969. And it came out, and the people were not even informed that the salmon were already in the Platte River hatchery and would be stocked the following spring. So this is the way that it used to work when the lakes had no friends. And the rest of the story on the salmon thing was, of course, we all know now that it was just a wildly lucky success. There were no downsides that have reared their heads that have been, you know, irreversible downsides to salmon. In fact, in Lake Huron, when the alewives disappeared, salmon pretty well disappeared. But during that salmon era, suddenly the lakes did have friends. There were $4 billion worth of sales annually in Michigan just for Great Lakes fishing after that happened. And of course, some of those $4 billion a year were fishing licenses that went to the agency, and suddenly the DNR started charging for fishing licenses to fish the Great Lakes and use that money to manage them. So now we have managers, and I worked at the Alpena Fishery Station, which did all the research on Lake Huron for the DNR. That was all funded by fishing dollars. So they suddenly had friends, and people started speaking up, like when we had the DDT issue. It wasn't birds that tipped the scales against DDT, it was fish. It was when people couldn't eat their salmon that people screamed. Mm-hmm. The Lansing Journal came out with an article saying, end of fishing in the Great Lakes, a headline, end of fishing in the Great Lakes. And 1 week later, 7 days later, the Free Press came out, their banner headline was, state bans DDT. Thanks to Dave Dempsey for that article. He sent it to me last week. And you know, 1 week later, 7 days, it took 7 days for the public to rear up and say, we're not taking this anymore. No more DDT in the state, and the state banned it. And it happened in the transition of two administrations, two governors. And it was a universal decision, and it was done. And then next thing they did is ban DDT, PCBs. So the
of course,
state,
not everything is quite so.
A leader.
It's not quite so clean cut and dramatic as that. Tell us what we can do on a day to day.
Yeah, that's
basis.
What we can do collectively. Mm-hmm. That's what we can do when we get together and our voices are heard. Individually, we can try to not be a vector. I mean, these invasive species should never have been allowed in the Great Lakes. There should have been more care taken before the locks were built to be sure that we didn't bring in 185 aquatic invasive species to the Great Lakes. But that didn't happen. Now what do we do? As individuals, we have to be thinking every time we move our boat or our waders from point A to point B, what's in this lake and how can we prevent it from getting over there? And just because we happen to like gobies doesn't mean we should say, hey, let's move these gobies from Lake Huron to Hubbard Lake, which apparently happened. There are four dams separating Hubbard Lake from Lake Huron. Gobies can't jump. They don't do very good swimming upstream even. And yet they showed up in Hubbard Lake within 10 years after they were first found in Lake Huron.
And that's an invasive.
How did that happen? The round goby is an invasive from the Caspian Sea. They do enjoy eating zebra and quagga mussels, which is a good thing. But somebody made a decision to move them to Hubbard Lake. You don't do that. Don't make decisions on behalf of the whole state of Michigan and just heap that responsibility on your shoulders. That's the agency's responsibilities. But more importantly, and I think more commonly, invasive species are spread by outboard motors, by the lower units, the water stored in them, by bilge water in your boat, and felt waders, waders of any kind, but especially the felt soles that make soles of waders less slippery, they're probably the biggest vector of New Zealand mud snails, which is a new invasive in Michigan. It's shown up in just a couple of our streams and up in the St. Mary's River. We don't want that moved around. It short circuits the food chain pretty much like zebra and quagga mussels do. Zebra and quagga mussels in the Great Lake just suck the life out of the water column. And we're afraid the same could happen in our inland streams with the New Zealand mud snail. So take care not to let your equipment move these critters around.
The issue of invasives got traction with this group. With the focus on rights and access to water, they quickly pivoted and included responsibility. That people who enjoy and use water have a responsibility to protect it. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources says nearly 50% of endangered or threatened species are at risk due to invasive species. And they seem constantly to remind people that we often contribute to the problem. People unintentionally spread invasives on their boots, tires, boats, firewood, pets, horses, and more. As Jim Johnson points out, once invasives are introduced, a whole new battle begins.
Once you're here already, it becomes a little bit like whack-a-mole, doesn't it? The problem rears up here and then over there. But once they're here, it's too late.
Right.
That's why I've been so emphasizing the point that we have to speak with a collective voice to the big issue of closing the door. If we closed the door in the first place, we wouldn't have these issues. And it's going to take a big and collective voice to get the administrators and regulators to do the right thing about the locks.
Yeah.
They're not really willing to do that. But if we all could speak up with one voice, yes, maybe they would. One smaller thing would be to deal with that lamprey control issue. Every single year we have to go after an appropriation for lamprey control, over $20 million. If we miss a year, the lampreys come back and we go back to alewife soup. So we can't afford to let lampreys come back. Every year, you know, like this year, we'll have a new batch of legislators who will need to learn about lamprey control and how important it is to fund it. If we could just have one constant source of revenue for lamprey control and be done with it, that would be a big step in the right direction. One guaranteed trust fund for lamprey control would be one item.
Okay, so like what you were saying about once invasive species are here is kind of like playing whack-a-mole with them and spending all this money on trying to figure out how we can get them out of where they are already or just maintain them as they are already. But I think it's also a huge part of it is going to have to be being smarter about what we bring in. Because I know, like autumn olive trees, when those got planted in here to help with like bush control and like helping with roughage for animals and whatnot, and then that went absolutely berserk. So I think it's about more about being smart about what we introduce and equally being smart about how we manage what we've already introduced, essentially.
They say an army travels on its stomach, but the fuel for the battle against invasives is money, both private donations and public funds, and that means it comes with a political battle. We hear part of that battle play out every year when funding is discussed for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. The GLRI was launched in 2010 to accelerate efforts to protect and restore the Great Lakes. That funding, along with hunting and fishing license revenue, is in large part what protects Michigan's environment. Both Jim Johnson and Jim Olson, who works with For Love of Water, or FLO, an environmental action group, as well as the Environmental Law and Policy Center, spoke about money.
It's honestly, I've spoken to many legislators who haven't even thought of this. They know it, but they don't think about it, that the Great Lakes are almost entirely funded with license revenues.
Right.
And almost no tax money goes in. Their constituents almost all think their tax dollars are going into the Great Lakes, and they're going, well, if nobody's complaining, I guess it's fine. But even the legislators don't think about it very much because they never hear from people. They never hear from people saying, tell me how my tax dollars are helping to make the Great Lakes better.
Well, the answer is
they're not.
Right. I mean, there's been a huge effort with the Howe Group, Healing Our Waters, and the Great Lakes Initiative has been able to fight hard and get approximately $300 million a year out of the federal government for the Great Lakes. That's been significant, but what's the observation I'm making is while this is happening, every year starts out, and it's not just the current administration in the federal government, it's been going on for some time. Both at the state and federal level, we've seen cutting of budgets of Department of Natural Resources and Department of Environmental Quality. There's been a downsizing that is really, I think, I know what it used to be like in the 70s and the 80s, Jim, and I know it's tougher now. Mm-hmm. I talked to people over in Gaylord and the district office. It's much tougher. And then you look at this $300 million, and what's interesting is the first thing out of the government's mouth is Great Lakes are not going to get anything this year. It's cut from the budget. So we all spend all of our energy to put the $300 million back in. Meanwhile, we don't have time to deal with what you just mentioned because we're captured by you're not getting it. Okay, we'll give it to you. And then that uses up 6 months of people's energy. So there, you know, the question you raise is very significant about where are those priorities? Where are the values? What's driving that?
The issue of using and protecting Michigan's lakes is multifaceted, and many of the strategies can be learned. At our conversation, participants talked about an elementary teacher in Alpena who's on the front line of educating the next generation of water protectors. Coming up, we'll visit his remote classroom at the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary, where fifth graders are teaching first graders. And they're all learning about microplastics, aquatic invertebrates, remotely operated underwater vehicles. It's something. When our show continues.
Financial support for WCMU's Third Coast Conversations comes from Michigan Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Learn more at MichiganHumanities.org.
Welcome back. I'm Amy Robinson. We're continuing our look back at our community conversation about rights and access to water. And this is where the conversation moves outside. On a beautiful spring day, to tag along with elementary school students who are taking a deep dive into issues of water quality. Bob Thompson teaches fifth graders at Ella White Elementary School in Alpena. He wants his kids engaged, and he's not shy about trying new things, which is why his class is on another field trip to the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary in Alpena. They come here often, and they do some pretty amazing work. They research water pollution, new technology, and, of course, invasive species. And part of their work involves advocacy. These kids present their findings to other classes in the school. They face one of adults' biggest fears, public speaking. I caught up with fifth graders Audrey Brown and Peyton Gohl and talked with them about what they're learning.
We are testing the beach sand and the 4 Mile Dam for the plastics.
Why is that important?
We're trying to like just see like what's in it and like tell people that there is plastic in it so they don't keep like putting it in the sand for that.
Did I see you earlier kind of teaching?
What? Yeah. Yes. So we are here with our first grade buddies from Lincoln. We are showing them how to do it too.
All right. And Peyton, how long have you been doing this kind of thing?
We just started like a couple months ago, and we've been doing presentations around our school to also spread awareness too.
How are these first graders doing?
They're doing really good. They're really cooperating, and they have many questions, so that's really great.
What are you hoping they learn from all this?
I'm hoping they learn that like there is plastic in the sand, because like maybe they don't really care about all that, but I want them to know that it also harms us too, because when we are drinking the water, this is all coming from the sand too.
So how does it get from the sand on the beach we're walking on and end up harming us?
Well, when we throw our plastic away, it obviously goes to the landfill. And so wind and rain will pick it up and take it to our rivers and lakes. And so once it's there for a while, it can go into little bits and it just washes up on the beach sand. So that's how it's harming us. And when we eat our fish, the fish think that the plastic is food. And so when we eat the fish, we're also getting the harmful plastic in our system.
What's the most interesting thing you've learned in this class? You've probably been in it a little while, right?
I just think it's really cool to, like, just, like, learn about, like, seeing all this and, like, doing the presentations to help, like, the plastics and spread awareness. I think that's cool.
So I'm going to ask you kind of a hard question because a lot of people twice your age aren't sure how to answer it, but do you know what you want to do when you grow up?
I think I want to be either, like, this, like a marine biologist or person, or like work at NOAA, or maybe like be a teacher.
And what about you, Peyton?
I would like to be a teacher.
That was Peyton Gohl and Audrey Brown, fifth graders at Ella White Elementary School in Alpena. So the teacher, Bob Thompson, the guy who takes a busload of fifth graders out to a marine sanctuary, and then for fun, brings along a passel of first graders for his kids to mentor while they're there. He was originally a robotics specialist in the Navy. He says he was offered a job with Hewlett-Packard, earning $60,000. That was 25 years ago. He decided instead to become a teacher. He says he still doesn't make 60 grand, but to watch him work, he loves what he does. He says this is a lot more fun. He loves to get up in the morning. He says he hates it if he has to call in sick. So we caught up with him at the Marine Sanctuary and talked with him a bit about how he immerses his students in education.
The project we started was, it's called the Thunder Bay River Watershed Project. And so it started as basically a site-based research project where we were just monitoring sites. So kids were interested in stuff that was going on. And so we just started with a small, you know, I think we only had one partner at the time, but it might have been Fish and Wildlife. And we just said, hey, let's go out and find out what's going on in the river. And we just started sampling, and then what happened was kids were like, well, what's going on further up the river? Then what's going on up further river? And so it just got a little bit bigger than what we could do as a single classroom. So we kind of then, the Great Lakes Stewardship Initiative was kind of spawning at that time as well. And so we became a partner with them, and that allowed us to branch the project out. So with those partners, we were able to get teachers in the four school districts that are kind of along the Thunder Bay River. Mm-hmm. And so we have teams of teachers and classrooms that are in those areas, and they're doing testing for us. And so the basic project is just simply collecting data, and making observations, and recording them and sharing them.
So we're going to take the coffee filter. Does everyone have a coffee filter now?
No.
Not yet? All right. So the first thing you want to do is you want to take like this on top.
And then what we do with that data is then initially, is it a problem? Is it not a problem? Is it something we should investigate? And some years students say, yeah, we want to investigate this or we want to investigate that. Other years they do, you know, like this year we're really focused on plastics and microplastic, but more of the advocacy part that they're really enjoying versus the research part. So it really just kind of flows to what they want. So we've got six projects, a couple of projects that really haven't kind of, they're just kind of low-level projects
it's
with students.
Plastic that makes its way to become microplastic.
So it's basically, if you take like a plastic bag or something, and then you use it one time, and then it just gets thrown away, and then it goes into the ocean.
How does it get to the ocean?
You throw it away, and I'm not...
Is it because how about some wind comes by and...
So the other one that we started that came out was River Raiders. River Raiders was focused in on rusty crayfish. And so we were out doing all these samplings early on, and then MSU came to us, one of the partners up here came to us and said, hey, we're building these invasive species kits. While you guys are out, can you guys scoop up rusty crayfish for us because we're building these kits? And we're like, oh, okay, we can do that. So just another station, another thing, fun thing for kids to do.
Oh, my goodness. It's
what does that look like? Does it look like a stick?
Yeah. It looks like it's carrying a stick.
It does look like a stick.
But that's his body?
Nope. So that is...
And then what happened with that project is that we're out there, we must have collected 500-600 crayfish or something in different parts of the river. And then one day, one of the kids just turned around to me and was like, how do we know what a native looks like? And from that project, it spawned into, and within 2 years, that became a full-fledged research project where we were pulling data and doing catch and release on the populations of how many crayfish were actually in, rusty crayfish were in the watershed. We found that earlier on in the 1970s, MSU, or I can't remember the exact researcher, did a survey in here, and on his survey report, he never recorded any rusty crayfish. He wasn't looking for any, but he was just surveying, but he didn't find any. But he did find seven native crayfish that were connected to the river and the river. Now, as we go through, we've been sampling this river for 8 years for crayfish. We've never found a native.
Really?
Never found a native. The only time we found a native, we found, like, if we go way to the end of the watershed and we go into some creeks or stuff like that that are not been necessarily connected to, or they're connected to the river, but they're on the way end of the beginning of it, we're finding them there. But even some of the lakes that we're sampling, Lake Esau up here by Grand Lake, it's protected, doesn't have anything in it. And we've been sampling up there for a couple of years. And if we first started sampling, we didn't find any rusty crayfish. Now we're finding a few. And even the man-made lake up here at Paxton Quarry, that's owned by Lafarge, and they're restoring it back to a lake. And when we first started sampling out there, we weren't finding any rusties in there. They were all natives. And there's only a spring feed that comes into. There's no way water that comes from the Great Lake. We're now finding rusties in it. And so the only way those rusties are getting there is by people bringing them. And so that part of that project turned into a large advocacy project in which we were just trying to make people aware of not transferring invasive species. And so that project, it won us a lot of national awards. We won some big support from Disney with that project as well. And we ended up making a lot of different promotional stuff with Michigan Sea Grant. We created some posters and informational stuff that went through U of M and went through the Sea Grant process, and actually can be purchased now on the Sea Grant site.
What we're working with today are chemicals. Can you always see the chemicals around you?
No.
It makes it kind of tough sometimes to test. Can you see an insect?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot easier. So we're gonna use some special chemicals to help you find the hydrogen ion, which represents pH, the nitrates, the ammonia, and the dissolved oxygen. So we're gonna end up breaking you into four groups.
Yeah, give us a sense for how widely this has been used. Some of your research, some of your advocacy materials.
Well, most of what we do is, again, I'm not, for myself, I'm just too, you know, it's my classroom, so I'm not a bigger part. That's part of the job. That's what happens with having the large network of people to support. They're out there taking what we're doing as a kind of like a case study, and then they're using bits and pieces and introducing it to different classrooms. That's the beauty of having NOAA up here, because NOAA acts as that hub. Northeastern Michigan Great Lakes Stewardship acts as that hub. So with NOAA, we've got more of a national presence in that they're sharing our stuff, they're using our sampling, our data, and then they're going out showing other classrooms how to do it and teaching other classrooms. And then, you know, and we're not the only classroom doing this. There's lots of classrooms all over the country that are doing it, but it's nice to be able to collaborate with them and get what their best case scenarios are, their testing stuff is. And so it's kind of all been working together that way. And the GLSI has also been allowing us to spread out regionally.
So to scoop up, so there, I got a little guy. All right, so I have a dragonfly baby.
So you're getting a lot of good data. You're letting the kids dip their toes into advocacy. Is part of this you just love being outside?
Be honest, I was just looking for a way to get my kids engaged in science. It's really hard to start. When I first started teaching, I got into the program that was put together, with Bob Ballard started. It's the Jason Expedition, Jason Project. And that just kind of did a lot what we did with scientists and partnering, but a lot of it was just online or through Skype with scientists. And none of it really focused towards our regional stuff. And so basically that just what happened. We just, at the time the school I was at, we had a stream that ran through it, and we just happened to have a local biologist stop by and visit us, and we were like, hey, what's something we could do? And he said, well, what happened to the salmon that used to be in this river? And then we just started researching that, and that became really our first project, and that led to zebra mussels, which led to quagga mussels, which led to rusty crayfish, which led to plastic and sturgeon and brown trout and lake trout, and so it just kind of snowballed.
How's it helped the engagement?
Oh, it's amazing. If you just use attendance data, so one of the things we monitor at our in our district, in our school, in attendance data, my classroom has the highest attendance rate. And out of like this month, other than a short stint of flu in the classroom, we've had the highest attendance rates every month. So we're in the 96% usually every month.
And you attribute that to this?
Oh, absolutely.
This kind of,
yeah, they want to be here. They want to do this stuff.
You're going to stop digging in the water? and you're going to use the key to identify the one that you have.
Are we
all
just
right?
For one?
Okay. So, no, you're going to do as
wait,
many as you can do.
Is there anyone in here?
There is. Hang on.
Okay.
Wait. We're not stopping yet. All right. Look at me again. Woo. Look at me. Everything. Sit down. Everything in these bases is finger friendly. What do you think that means?
You can grab it.
You know, we were looking in our community conversation about the importance of teaching people how to care for the lakes. How much of an impact do you think this is going to have when they're adults?
Well, we're just hoping that we can initiate the conversation with them, get them interested in water quality, and then just, and overall, just getting them connected to our lakes and our rivers in our area. And our goal or our model has always been that, you know, if we can get kids to love our area, then they'll protect that area. And regardless about how much, you know, they know about water quality and the biology of the macroinvertebrates, but if they build that connection with our area, they always will have that going throughout life,
guys,
and that's the goal.
Attention. All right, so we took care of aquatic. Aquatic means where do they live?
Water.
Invertebrate means?
No back.
No backbones. Macro.
Tiny.
Do you think?
Yes.
Like how tiny?
Like
the size of a puppy?
That size.
Smaller than a puppy. Small, so small that you can barely see it. Do you have to have a microphone?
And we hear so much about how hands-on can be so much more meaningful than sitting in a classroom listening to a lecture day after day after day.
Sure.
What kind of response do you get from the kids?
Oh, it's fantastic. These kids, you know, most of them, like, for example, the two girls in there that are running the station in there, and they're sampling for microfibers and just fibers in general. They've taken that project on, and they're fifth graders, and they're running it. And they've done that presentation this year with probably 20 different classrooms, and they've done it all on their own. And so right now they're in that advocacy mode right now where they're out there sharing. We're collecting data. It's actually sand samples that we've collected along the way, so dual purpose. We're running our own samples, but yet we're teaching other kids about fiber in the water. And that's something people don't think about when they look at fiber, you know. But it's interesting, you go out there and screen that water with a plankton net. It's chock full of fiber.
Fiber, what are you finding? What do you say fiber? What does that
fiber
mean?
Fiber from your clothes, microfibers, plastic fibers, fleece. Fleece being the number one. So if you get a chance to go over there, you'll see it, and it'll just come out, and they're filtering the sand. We know there's fiber in the water. The other thing we're researching this year is how much fiber's in the sand, how much is in the substrate of the rivers and the lake. And so we developed a sampling method with the help of NOAA, and then the University of Florida had a sampling protocol. So we reached out to them a couple years ago, and we just kind of slowly built some partners, and then we came up with a practical elementary sampling method in which we could do fairly inexpensively and yet but still get some results that are real. And so the method they're using has been running for 3 years, and we finally just kind of refined it this year. And so it's yielding really well. So we're seeing fibers in throughout the sands. We're seeing them on the beaches around Alpena. We're finding them in the substrates of the river, and we're finding them out in the bay.
What are the problem with fibers in water and sand?
It's the same as anything. It's the pollutant, right? And so the big worry about those fibers being in the sand is that with the infestation of quagga mussels, and not so much zebra mussels out in the lake now, but those quagga mussels lay on the bottom of the, and then what happens is as they're you know, as they're eating, digesting, and that digestion, that waste is creating bacteria on the bottom of the lake, that bacteria is aerating, or it's breaking that plastic down. And then those toxins that are within the plastic are being released not only in the sand but into the water. And so we're just trying to get a general idea as to, well, how big is the problem, how much fiber is out there.
And what do you know?
We don't have finite numbers because we're fifth graders. But what we're finding, like at the beach, if we sample 1 kilogram sand, we're finding, like right over here in this local beach, we found about 13 pieces of fiber per 1 kilogram of sand.
Is that considered high?
Be honest, I don't know. We're going off data. NOAA did some research a few years back with different beaches around the country. I think it was the national parks. And they were finding the range from 13 to 35. So we're just glad that our data showed up close to what theirs was.
That was Bob Thompson, fifth grade teacher at Ella White Elementary School in Alpena. It's his creativity that drives the effort to help fifth graders become good environmental stewards and, if it suits them, good entrepreneurs. His students have helped write grants. Every student has a Chromebook, and they've helped start a business using their own product.
One of the side projects we've got going is called, it's called Yowing for Conservation. And so we're trying, again, we generate a lot of, we do a lot of field trips, so it requires a lot of funding. And so one of the things the kids dreamed up was, well, why don't we just start a school store, start, you know, we start running our own stuff. So we have our own bank of 3D printers in the classroom. And then, so we use those 3D printers to manufacture things. And one of the things we manufacture is a yo-yo. It's just a basic, simple yo-yo. And so the kids put it together, they assemble it, we print the parts, put them together, and then we have a group of kids that run the school store. And then from that school store, we sell different things, and we turn out our own projects with the 3D printers. And the kids design them, build them, run them. They do all of the economics part of that. And then we have a team of kids that do all of the sales.
And that's all through your science classroom?
It's all through just I'm just a general fifth grade teacher.
Oh,
I have a self-contained fifth grade classroom.
Okay. What else do we need to know? What have I not talked about that...
You can spend a
You're
whole
a
day
guy.
Just, we're busy. We have an after-school program for elementary and junior high and high school that focuses primarily on the development of underwater research and different land robotics as well. We meet a couple times a week, and that's where these high school kids still stay. Even though they were once fifth graders, they've been with me for, you know, since fourth and fifth grade.
It seems there's a history of environmental studies in Alpena schools. We have just a few more minutes left in this program, and coming up, we're going to take a look at part of the conversation that got a lot of positive feedback from participants, an explanation of what the law allows you to do on Michigan waters.
Financial support for WCMU's Third Coast Conversations comes from Michigan Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Learn more at MichiganHumanities.org.
Welcome back to our program. I'm Amy Robinson. We're exploring issues related to water, who has access, and what responsibilities do users have to protect the resource. This program stems from a recent project at WCMU. Michigan Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities provided funding to allow us to host a series of community conversations about water. Our first conversation was held last fall in Alpena. We invited educators, fishermen, community volunteers, retirees, and outdoor enthusiasts, among others. We also invited two experts to help answer questions and to provide a factual framework that we could all work from. An important part of the discussion was water law, and we had just the right person to explain. This is how we started.
All right, so let's start our conversation getting some information we can all work from a shared knowledge base. And so our first expert is Jim Olson right here, and Jim is the founder and president of Flow. Flow is for Love of Water. It's a water advocacy group, is that correct?
Independent research policy, and we think the work we do speaks for the advocacy.
Okay, very good. He's also been practicing law since 1972. And he specializes in environmental, water, land use, natural resource law, among a couple of other things that aren't quite as relevant to us tonight. He's graduated from Detroit College of Law and then earned his Master of Law from University of Michigan. And again, even then, when he was finishing up in college, he focused on public lands, natural resources, and environmental law. In short, he knows water law. And that's what we want to ask him today. So, Jim, you had a couple thoughts to get us started with.
Well, I think one of the main thoughts I'd like to leave you with, and it really is what we do at Flow. Flow is a nonprofit policy center that has one mission, and the mission is to protect the integrity of the quantity and quality of the water in the Great Lakes Basin. We think that if we do that, because water is in the hydrosphere and flows through all of our lives, we think if we do that, in this century, we will make very good decisions about health, community, water, environment, quality of life, and economy. And so we're really excited about that. So from that framework and mission, we have found that legal principles surrounding water are as important and run through I would say water in the same way that water runs through every arc of the water cycle on the Earth. And so I'm excited to be here this evening to share those principles with you as you have questions.
So let's outline a couple of those laws that I think it's going to be really helpful for us to know. And the first one that you and I had talked about, explain to us, what is the public trust doctrine?
Well, the public trust doctrine is really one of our most important principles in water law. But until the last 20 or 30 years, it was not that common in terms of personal knowledge of people. It actually started about 1,500 years ago with the Justinian Codes, where in civil law at that time, water was considered to be shared in common by all, not owned by anyone, because it was moving and running at all times, and that also included the seas and the seashore. Fundamentally, access and use of water for certain things that the public needs for their life, to sustain their life, all right? Then the public trust doctrine showed up in the Magna Carta because the lords got special favors from the crown. And what happened was the crowns gave the lords special privileges, exclusive privileges on some of the tide influence seashore rivers. And the lords could exclude the commoner. And the common people rose up. And in the Magna Carta, that great charter of liberty, are paragraphs that prohibit the crown from denying access to the seas and the navigable waters to all people of a country. That principle came to this country. And I'll just say one more thing. This is a recognized principle in every state of the United States and in Canada, in the English-speaking world, and mostly civil law world in the Western Hemisphere and beyond. In 1892, the U.S. Supreme Court got a case where Illinois had deeded a square mile of Lake Michigan, just off of Jackson Park, basically, in Chicago, to a railroad company. And the railroad company was going to build a big beachhead industrial complex. The new legislature was upset, the people of Chicago were upset, so the state repealed the law. Asked the company for the deed back, the company refused. It gets into the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, going back to that Justinian Code, ruled that, wait a minute, these Great Lakes, being navigable, are owned by each state for the people who are beneficiaries. The government is a trustee, and the government does not have the power to convey away the waters and bottomlands and seashore, or lake shore, like in the Great Lakes, to a private person for private gain and profit. So there is this limitation on selling that. Now, as we enter this century, in fact, we've entered it, that becomes one of the major principles against which we're seeing a massive effort worldwide by others to try and figure out how to privatize this commons. So the public trust doctrine becomes, in a sense, our treaty, just like our first American and Native American people.
Okay? So it essentially says the government's holding the water in trust for the people.
In trust for the people or beneficiaries, no public, no private purpose, and no impairment of quality or quantity from one generation to the next. There is a perpetual duty of government not to let that happen. So how did we get all these problems? That's the question, but that's the principle.
Well, let me ask you, we have a couple more laws and a couple more minutes. Riparian law.
Riparian law governs lakes and streams. If you're a landowner that touches a lake or a stream, a water course, then you have the right of reasonable use of that water. And you share that reasonable use with others in that lake or stream that have property in that lake or stream. Others who do not have ownership of that land do not have the riparian rights of that water, only he or she who owns the land. So in a watershed, you can do a lot with the land, but you cannot unreasonably interfere with your neighbor's use or harm it, either in quality or quantity. Now there's a little footnote to reasonable use and riparian rights, and that is it's supposed to benefit the estate. So you're actually not supposed to be able to disconnect the water from the land and divert it and sell it somewhere else. That's changed. So there's a tension in all these principles.
Mm-hmm.
What about groundwater law?
Well, there are four doctrines of groundwater in the United States. I won't go into them. I'll talk about the doctrines here in the Great Lakes region and the eastern U.S. It's similar to the reasonable use doctrine. It's called reasonable user, or in some instances, the correlative rights doctrine. It's almost the same. All landowners, or people who occupy lawfully land, live in your home, operate a farm, a business, they have a right to use the groundwater percolating from the rain and moving by gravity through their property to some wetland and recharging in a lake or a stream or wetland. Everybody has, like riparian owners, a reasonable use of that water to benefit their overlying estate. Okay? They cannot interfere unreasonably with another neighbor. And now if there's a drought, everybody has to reduce their amount of use. There's no right to an exact amount of use. You correlatively have to reduce it as the natural water cycle moves the groundwater table up and down. Okay? So that is essentially groundwater law. There is again a footnote like riparian law. You're not supposed to divert groundwater from your property if you want to sell it in some distant land out of the watershed. So we have this basic principle that protects the water in watersheds against diversions and sale, but the courts in the states have opened up the door some because of packaged water or bottled water. There is diversion going on because of that, and that's one of the big issues of the day, is how do we deal with that? What's fair? What's just? But that's basically groundwater law.
Well, one more thing before we move on, and that is, what does the Michigan Constitution tell us?
The Michigan Constitution has say two things. Article 4, Section 52 says, somewhat like the public trust doctrine, that the air and the water and the natural resources of the state of Michigan are of paramount public concern. In other words, there's a public interest that is paramount to all other uses and interests when it comes to air, water, and natural resources. And that's significant because paramount means above all else. If you look at it in the dictionary, above all else. So the legislature is mandated shall enact laws that protect the air, water, and natural resources and the public trust of Michigan's environment from pollution, impairment, or destruction. So the legislature did that when they passed a law called the Michigan Environmental Protection Act. That is a constitutionally based statute that is a basic charter of every citizen in the state. It puts a duty on government to protect the environment, and it gives citizens the right to demand, if necessary, in court to make the government do just that.
Laws are often shaped with real-world challenges. Jim touched on some of the issues that have affected water use and water law.
You take invasive species, we have that. We have crude oil in the Great Lakes. We have aquaculture farms. Do we farm the Great Lakes, or is our farm supposed to be on land? Since when does a riparian owner have a right to dock? Yes. Do you have a right to build a 10-acre farm where people have a public right to use that under the public trust doctrine? Climate change? Climate change is one of the biggest diversions of water in the Great Lakes. It drops water faster than any diversion of the Great Lakes, or rises it faster, particularly if you live on the shore. So, you know, there's just one issue after another, and they're all connected. And we're at a time in history where, you know, the international panel on climate change just came out, speaking to all of us in this room, that we have about 12 to 20 years to keep the Earth's rise in temperature to about 1.5 rather than 2, otherwise things are going to get pretty messy. And so what is our role, mm-hmm. as Amy has been asking and as you've been talking, and what are the principles that help us get there, and the organizing and the hope? But hearing this, I'm glad I'm here this evening. You all give me a lot of hope.
That was Jim Olson with For Love of Water. To find out more about water law, legal challenges, and other issues, you can go to flowforwater.org. So, in the end, what did we learn with our community conversation? That there's a lot to learn about water use and water law. That people can learn environmental stewardship skills. That a room full of people can have a civil conversation about an important issue. Now, this wasn't our only conversation, and coming up next week, we'll revisit our community conversation in Petoskey, where we discussed how water creates a sense of place and all that that entails. And you can find this special, photos of our Alpena journey, and supplemental materials at our website, wcmu.org. Until next week, good night.